we wanted to bring something for women that really stood on its own feet, so to speak, something that was made specifically for women without sacrificing the Red Wing DNA.
Today's show really begins way back in 1905 in a small American town called Red Wing. The famous shoe company bearing the town's name is still family-run and proudly made in America. We'll find out how Red Wing keeps its eyes on the future while paying careful tribute to its past. Today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Ben Rylan. Also today,
it's very much part of that historical dynamic to open up, to connect, but also to find new forms of production and new source of inspiration beyond sheer production.
We'll take a ferry to the brand new Victoria and Albert Design Society in Shenzhen. And
so you have the tummy warmer, but you have it sticking out of the bottom of your jumper as opposed to the top of your trousers. They've got ones that are sort of like blue, red and white striped, and you can just see the bottom hanging out of a guy's jumper, and it does look really cool.
We'll step inside the closet of our own Jamie Waters for a look at some staples of this season's wintry wardrobe. All that coming up right here on Section D. Shenzhen, China's economic powerhouse of the south, can now add a decidedly more artistic feather to its cap. The city is currently promoting a grand plan that will, hopefully, result in a reinvention of the city from factory of the world to city of design. A new waterfront cultural complex has just been unveiled, the first project by Japanese architect Fumihiko Maki. It's home to a new project known as Design Society, spearheaded by China's Merchants Shiku, in partnership with London's Victoria and Albert Museum, the first such partnership between a Chinese state-owned enterprise and an international museum. Monocle's Kurt Lin stepped aboard a ferry in central Hong Kong and, after about an hour, he arrived in Shiku for a chat with Ollie Boomen, the director of Design Society, and Tim Reeve, deputy director of the V&A, to find out more about the project's ambitions.
Where we find ourselves is actually on a spot where we can overlook the bay of Pearl River and see Hong Kong on the other side and seeing the bridge connecting Shenzhen and Hong Kong. And also seeing ferries going back and forth to Hong Kong Airport. And it's a place also to be connected by container terminal industry to represent, let's say, the heydays of industrial growth of China, but certainly Shenzhen as a special economic zone, and a place where modern China has been, let's say, incubated and tested for many years. Shekou has been pivotal in that development, because even before there was a special economic zone in Shenzhen, there was already the Shekou experiment, started by one of the senior managers of China Merchants in the post-industrial shift, so to speak, is of course to find new ways or new reasons or new causes to drive growth, but also to find purpose for the Shekou community. So when we talk about a new design institution here, it's very much part of that historical dynamic to open up, to connect, but also to find new forms of production and new source of inspiration beyond sheer production. Mm. And creativity, making things, create things, is, let's say, the most obvious next chapter after the industrial miracle. So what we would like to do here is to provide a platform where all new experiment in making things and creating design are going to be embraced, celebrated, exposed, tested, and hopefully even proven by a ecosystem program, as I call it, that includes a very strong cultural component with a partnership with the Victoria and Albert Museum. And the big challenge for Shekou in the post-industrial shift, so to speak, is of course to find new ways or new reasons or new causes to drive growth, but also to find purpose for the Shekou community. So when we talk about a new design institution here, It's very much part of that historical dynamic to open up, to connect, but also to find new forms of production and new source of inspiration beyond sheer production. Mm. And creativity, making things, and create things is, let's say, the most obvious next chapter after the industrial miracle. So what we would like to do here is to provide a platform where all new experiment in making things and creating design are going to be embraced, celebrated, exposed, tested, and hopefully even proven by a ecosystem program, as I call it, that includes a very strong cultural component with a partnership with the Victoria and Albert Museum.
蛇口已经成为了深受深圳市民喜爱的城市地标和文化。
We were approached through a kind of mutual friends back in 2011 by China Merchants Group, who were keen to have a new design platform as part of their development of 蛇口. After we had got to know each other over a period of a couple of years, it became clear that there was a great partnership to be had out of it, and we had some common objectives. That led to a contract that we signed back in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office during Premier Li's visit in 2014, and here we are 3 years later with Design Society opening. So these things take time in the early stages and then accelerate.
How do you describe the partnership and how, like, your role in playing in this Design Society?
We describe it as the V&A being the founding partner in the creation of Design Society. So Design Society is founded by China Merchants Group and the V&A working together to create a new institution called Design Society. So the first thing for the V&A is that we're providing advice and support across a whole raft of areas to do with museum operation and museum development. Collections management, security, environmental controls, all of the things that are very familiar to us at the V&A, but you know, if you've not done them before, you know, you need to sort of learn how to do them. Then obviously there's a content component to it, so the main thing being the V&A Gallery of Design, which will be here in Sheko for 2 years, 250 objects from the V&A collection, including 50 new acquisitions from in around Shenzhen. That will be followed by two exhibitions from the V&A's touring program, which will come in 2019 and 2020. So there's a big content component, V&A exhibitions, V&A objects in front of this audience. Then the third thing is developing a series of kind of networks to develop a really coherent and ambitious learning and engagement program to make sure that audiences from the local area, maybe from Hong Kong, but Shenzhen more broadly, feel like this is a platform that has been created for them. So kind of a big program of outreach to make sure that there is an audience that really kind of feel like this is something that's been created with their interests in mind.
So it seems that the positioning of this project is very different from the traditional sense of museum or gallery, like the M+ in Hong Kong is opening next year. So it's not a competitive relationship with galleries or big museums around in the region, but it has a unique, more even commercial values to creative.
I would say even if we would do exactly the same as M+, it still would not be competitive, because this is such a vast urban field that includes more than 150 million people, you know, from Guangzhou to Macau and Zhuhai and Hong Kong, Shenzhen in between. There is plenty of space to explore and experiment with new design institutions, but we are not doing exactly the same, for sure. And I think what you're saying is right, is correct. We try to provide a platform rather than a museum in terms of building up a collection or in terms of making shows as the only core business. We have deliberately called ourselves Design Society, in Chinese, Shiji Hulian, and not calling ourselves Boguguan, not calling ourselves Design Museum. Because museum, once you call it that way, people will directly think about, oh, that is about collection, that's about precious things, especially in the Chinese language. Boguguan even means preserving precious things. So that's not our intention. We would like to be forward-looking, not consolidating, opening up rather than closing the narrative. Not about canonization or about just confirm reputations, but really explore new things. And the partners we are looking for, and that's almost like an open invitation to good ideas, are the partners who are also at a cutting edge of what they can do as a brand or as a piece of design or as a talent, and to match it or to test it by the Shenzhen environment. And that's what should happen on the platform, but it's certainly also what should happen by our support to those initiatives, to make them find the right customers, the right makers, the right manufacturers, and maybe the right distributors in China.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. In
the real kind of vision behind Design Society was a member of the senior management team of China Merchants Group in Jianglin, Robert. You know, it's his idea. He has a real passion for it. He thinks it's very important, and I think he's right. So he has always, throughout this partnership, been the driving force from China Merchants side. He's always taken a very keen interest in it. And then obviously, as we've gone through the years, more people have been recruited to actually run Design Society, and it has its own leader, its own director now, Nolly Bauman. And there's obviously a key part of it was presenting our gallery concept to China Merchants Group senior management, so the exhibition concept and then the design concept. Again, they were very interested in what we were doing and the objects we would use, but that process was actually very, very straightforward. And I think they took the view that this was something that we knew a lot about and that they trusted our judgment to come up with a gallery that was going to be relevant, important, interesting for Shenzhen. So they've not, they've been involved, but they've not interfered.
So in this partnership, there is a term, for
5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
So it's going to be ending in 2 years. It's not the right question to ask when you guys are opening today, but what's next? How do you see in the next 2 years and beyond?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, today is a kind of celebration, and two years seems a long way away. But I think the important thing from my perspective is to see how visitors react to what's being created here over the next 6 months. Really deciding what we're going to do in 2019. It's just too early until you've really seen how people respond to it. You don't really know whether it's been a success. I'm very confident it will be seen as a very successful collaboration. But let's see what the general public feel about it. And then we'll use that information and that feedback to decide what happens next and whether there's a new opportunity with China Merchants Group somewhere in China, but let's see.
Ollie Boomen, Director of Design Society, and Tim Reeve, Deputy Director of the V&A, speaking to Monocle's Kurt Lin. Now, we couldn't end 2017 without paying tribute to the esteemed graphic designer Ivan Chermayev, who passed away this month at the age of 85. Among his iconic designs were logotypes for New York's Museum of Modern Art, underpinned by the Franklin Gothic No. 2 font, and LA's Museum of Contemporary Art. He was also a co-founder of the design studio Chermayev and Geismar and Haviv, whose work includes NBC's famous Rainbow Peacock and the classic world map line drawing behind the Pan Am brand. The Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Get in touch by emailing me, Ben Rylan, on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Stay tuned. Winter is upon us here in London, and if you're without a big warm coat, well, we might have a few suggestions for you. Monocle's assistant fashion editor, Jamie Waters, sits down with Section D's Josh Fennett now for a look at some winter wardrobe essentials.
It's kind of this interesting phenomenon that at the moment, and sort of also looking to the future, a lot of big brands that are doing well have this embrace this kind of really colorful maximalist sort of dressing. So the king of it is Gucci. So they're kind of the sort of trailblazers. And Alessandro Michele has sort of, his designs are really fantastical and over the top, and there's all these sequins and bright colors and opulent fabrics. And what people have said, I mean, the thing I wrote about was basically that there is a kind of phenomenon that in really depressed times, so whether it's economically, politically, socially, there's this sort of phenomenon of people wanting to buy happiness. So you want something that is this kind of form of escapism. And it kind of, I spoke to a few psychologists and they said that there is something to be said for it. Buying anything, you get sort of endorphins, but then if you buy something particularly bright or something that people are likely to comment on, you kind of get these sort of hits of endorphins when people comment on it. There is method behind the madness. And I mean, we're seeing it, so it's not just Gucci, but the other thing that they've said is you need to be authentic because we want to buy things that are happier, but we don't want someone to just slap a slogan on the
on a sweater if it doesn't sort of fit the brand DNA. So you have to do it in a kind of tactful way. And interestingly, it's the Italian brands that have this kind of history of being a bit quirky. And so they're the ones who are doing selling happiness well, and they're the ones who are posting good financial results. So like Miu Miu, Fendi, and obviously Gucci.
And so tell me, you've got three items which you're recommending us for winter. The first one looks a bit like a kind of like old English cotton traders sort of style rugby top. Is that because you imagine yourself sort of in a happy rugby match of some sort, and editorially, if nothing else? Tell us about the first brand.
This, I am a big fan of rugby jumpers at the moment. So they have been touted as something that's going to explode in the coming months and next year. But the thing I like about this brand, so the brand is called McGill. The particular jumper I picked is bright yellow. That's because I love yellow. I think it's interesting because the guy, the designer, he's previously been at Jack Spade, Ralph Lauren, Tommy Hilfiger, a lot of these kind of preppy American brands. But I like that he's based in LA. They're all made in LA. But it is a very British thing as well. So I think the rugby jumper, you can see the kind of preppy American kind of thing, but you do think of it as being a very British thing. It's very simple, his design, but he's got like an M stitched into the sort of placket. And I kind of like the idea of, I mean, it's that sporty influence, and we, you know, athleisure, that awful word that we keep hearing. But I think this is quite a cool way to it. It's very understated, and it's kind of, you know, like a big oversized rugby jumper untucked. That kind of fits my disheveled sensibility.
And the next brand is one that keen-eyed Monocle readers may have heard of before. I believe it's a duo, and I believe they're based in Antwerp. But tell me a little bit more about Howlin and why you like their knitwear this season.
Yeah, so I want to talk about them because for a couple of reasons. I think they're like the kings of knitwear. They're like the ultimate. I think if you're getting a knitted jumper this winter, I think they're always good. We are profiling them in one of the upcoming newspaper stories. So, you know, I think it's a good reason to talk about them. A couple of brothers, Patrick and Ian Olleschlager. I hope I've said that correctly.
And it goes more international than that, doesn't it? Because I think they're based in Antwerp. But didn't they have some connection with an old Scottish woolen mill at some point, and they decided to help revive the brand?
Yes, they've got this interesting heritage. Their parents were designers of knitwear. So when the two brothers decided, they said they wanted to do something really singular, which I think in itself is a clever thing to do, a la sort of Stutterheim or those brands that pick one product. And they said, well, let's do knitwear because our parents used to have a label in the 80s. And so they kind of have, in a way, retraced their parents' steps, sourced these mills in Scotland where the wool comes from, where a lot of the pieces are made. But they've kind of put this modern spin on it. And there's a couple of pieces I really like. I mean, they do like the plain charcoal coloured knits. They do all those sorts of things that you could want. But in their sort of autumn winter collection, I've got this piece here, which is, it's a blue jumper with clouds all over it. And I think, you know, there's always room for a bit of fun. Again, that's that happiness thing. But I think it's nice and quirky. And I think if you can, you know, make people smile, that's always a good thing.
Last but not least, there's sometimes in the Monocle editorial meetings, I don't think I'm shining too much of a light on proceedings upstairs on the editorial floor here at Midori House, but occasionally stories get kind of narrowed down to a couple of words, and Japanese tummy warmers has been one of those kind of strange sobriquets I've been hearing battered around between you and our editors. What on earth is a Japanese tummy warmer, and why are you telling us about it?
We have a big expose on the curious business of Japanese tummy warmers in the first newspaper issue. And basically, our Asia bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, has written this very funny piece about this phenomenon in Japan, which is basically the tummy warmer, or haramaki is the Japanese term for it, has been around for a long time. Apparently, way back, originated from the warrior's armour. And then in kind of the, I think like the sort of 50 or 60 years ago, they became, that turned into these like stretchy, you know, either like nylon or sort of wool
listeners kind of get it. It's almost like the kind of nori seaweed wrapping on a piece of sushi, isn't it? It's just kind of round the belly.
Around the middle. Exactly right. It's like this stretchy kind of tube. And it apparently used to be big among pensioners, and it's seen as quite a dorky kind of thing, except now there's these cool young brands that are kind of reinventing it, bringing it to a new audience. I remember when I was reading Fiona's thing, I was like, you know, you start at the start, you're like, this is very odd, isn't it? And then sort of 500 words in, I was ready to place an order. I was like, I need one of these things. And as she says, Japanese people are very good at inventing things you didn't know you needed, and then you think, oh, I couldn't live without it. And I think this is one of those things. But what these young brands are doing, says one called Hobonichi, which is apparently like the sort of the one to watch. They're encouraging their young sort of customers to wear them Calvin Klein style. So you have the tummy warmer, but you have it sticking out of the bottom of your jumper as opposed to the top of your trousers. And so they've got ones who are that are sort of like blue, red and white striped, and you can just see the bottom hanging out of a guy's jumper. And it does look really cool. So I don't know if I can pull that off though.
Monocle's Jamie Waters taking us inside his winter wardrobe with Josh Fannett. There's something about classic workwear that transcends utility. Form follows function, and sometimes fashion follows along. Think of dungarees, denim jeans, army boots. It's an idea that applies to Red Wing shoes as well. The family-owned and operated American brand was started by a German immigrant in small-town Minnesota in 1905, and many of its works and hunting boots are still made there today. And with such a rich history under its wing, they've wisely dipped into their own archives for inspiration when creating the Heritage line. It's a passion project for Alison Gettings, part of the fourth generation of her family to run Red Wing. She spoke to Monocle's contributor Susan Stone in Berlin recently at the opening of the very first ever women's Red Wing store.
It's a fairly true statement to say that this has been a lifelong dream of mine. I mean, I can't even tell you how humbling it is to be here today. I've been wanting to make shoes for women for my family's company since I knew how to tie a shoe. And it's something that, I mean, especially my mother and I have talked about forever. You know, Dad, come on, why don't you make a women's shoe? Make something that I want to wear. So having this opportunity has been the most dramatic of amazing life experiences. So I'm currently the director of product for our Heritage brand. So I'm involved in everything from deciding which products to come up with to making the style happen. So everything from idea to boot.
Now, when you introduced the women's collection, you had to introduce some design changes as well.
It was such a fun challenge because Red Wing has always been such a masculine brand. And we wanted to bring something for women that really stood on its own feet, so to speak. Something that was made specifically for women without sacrificing the Red Wing DNA. So the first thing I did was really try to identify what is it that makes a Red Wing a Red Wing? What are the core pieces that we need to protect and keep sacred? And then what are the things that women are looking for that maybe would turn them off to our products that we need to be able to change? You know, the men's products are pretty bulky on the foot. They have a long break-in period for women. And women wanted something that was just a little bit more comfortable, maybe a little bit more lightweight. And obviously products that are versatile, that they can wear with a lot of different outfits. And so those are the things that we attempted to change. So all of our women's products have their own last, which is the form that the shoe is shaped around. Even if you see like our 6-inch mock toe, if you look at the men's boot and then you see the women's version, they look like they could be the same boot. But from the ground up, they're actually completely reconstructed for women. So on that particular boot, we came up with completely new outsoles that are made out of a lighter weight material, which, by the way, is also more durable and has more comfort features in it because it's a polyurethane. We redeveloped all of our leathers to be a little bit lighter weight and a little bit softer. And then the proportions of the shoes all had to change then. So the eyelets are a little bit smaller. The stitch lines were tweaked just here and there to make sure that they really flattered a woman's foot. The guts of the shoes are also a different material. So we used a different kind of what we call a lasting board that has a little more flex in it. And then we put layers of cushioning on top of that lasting board so that it has and a nice cush comfort for women right out of the box when they try it on.
And one of the things that you had to think about is the addition of the heel.
Yeah, so one of our collections, the modern collection, does have a stacked leather heel. It's actually completely solid leather stacked all the way through, which is somewhat rare in footwear today.
You can see it in the stripes, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's actually a resin layer. It's a leather, resin, It's called a robust stack teal. But yeah, we wanted also to offer women something that played off of our iconic styles a little bit, that felt a little more feminine, and gave them something to wear that could potentially be more sophisticated or more refined.
Red Wing has quite a history, and it dates back to 1905, but women's shoes also have a history with Red Wing.
We actually started making shoes for women in 1926, was our first pair. It was a tall lace-up boot, and it was called the Gloria back then. And it was based off of a men's style that we had, and it was something that men and women used for hiking. It was a hiking boot, a tall lace-up boot.
So is that Gloria up there on the shelf?
That's the Gloria. So for this collection, we reproduced the Gloria, and we stayed as true to we could as the original design. We have a new last, obviously, so that the silhouette fits women's feet today and feels fresh. But you'll see we're true to a lot of the original details, particularly in the fact that there's no zipper in this knee-high lace-up boot, which you see pretty much in every other brand. So it takes some commitment and dedication to lace them up. But they are definitely a statement style piece.
What are the sort of iconic shoes? I would say the mock toe, which has this sort of crepe, this white sole or light colored sole, which a lot of people might know.
You nailed it. So this 6-inch mock is truly our most iconic piece. It's the number one seller for us on both the men's and women's line. And it's something with that white sole is immediately recognizable as a Red Wing. You see a lot of this white sole actually on other styles. We did invent it back in the 1960s with Vibram. So we were the first ones to really pioneer the style, which is always fun to know. And then the Iron Ranger is the second highest selling boot for us right now, and also iconic with the leather cap over the toe. And then the two rows of Puritan stitching across that toe cap are really the standout features of it, but make it, again, instantly recognizable.
And in the work boot version, maybe it's a metal toe or
a steel toe? Mm-hmm. Well, the cap toe was the precursor to the steel toe. So we came out with a style 1920s, 1930s to help protect someone's foot. So there's actually a full second leather piece over it. So you have like a double layer of leather to give you that extra protection before steel toes were invented.
The Heritage Collection itself has a kind of an interesting backstory, starting with some Red Wing fans in a far-off place, far from Minnesota.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so actually in the late 1970s, we started selling products to Japan through a distributor called Midori, and they had been selling our work products, which is the bulk of our business. We make work boots. The Japanese people were less inclined to wear them for work, actually, but were really interested in them as a fashion statement. And it took off really quickly. We had a celebrity in Tokyo who wore them off the set and in a movie. They became very fast sellers almost overnight. And so Japan has really been the backbone of this heritage business for a long time. We came to Europe next and started distribution throughout Europe. And just really in the last 10 years, we've created an organization around it back home at our headquarters, where it's treated as its own brand now, and we have our own product development resources dedicated toward it and our own marketing staff dedicated toward it. So it's been real organic growth, you could say.
Alison Gettings there from Red Wing Boots. She was speaking to Susan Stone. Next week, we'll turn our attention to the art of building big things with two architectural giants, Ollie Screen and Jamie Furbert. Section D was researched by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Sarah Miles. I'm Ben Ryland. We'll catch you next time.